The Lord of Eden moved through the tunnels at a brisk pace, his thoughts on the newcomers. He'd been observing them for the last several hours, and it was clear by their actions and lack of familiarity with the complex that they were newcomers, which meant that some other outside group had taken an interest in the activity here. That in itself was interesting. Outsiders wouldn't understand what his captors had tried to do, wouldn't know why the various wards and barriers had been erected. Without that knowledge, he reasoned, they would be more likely to help him escape the confines of the complex, might even unintentionally break the bonds that held him without knowing what they were doing. That would be fortunate indeed. But if he was not so lucky, there were other ways to persuade them to help. For all he knew, they might even listen to reason. And if they chose to oppose him, he would deal with them in an appropriate manner, just as he had with the others before them. He had been locked in the darkness for too long to allow anything, least of all a group of weakling humans, to prevent him from regaining his rightful heritage. He would do what needed to be done, just as he always had. And the Creator be damned if he didn't like it. An odd sensation washed over him, like a sudden dousing of ice-cold water, the walls around him wavering like a mirage on the hot desert plains that he had haunted so long ago. And the feeling was so unexpected that it stopped him in mid-stride. He was intimately familiar with the sensation. It wasn't its unusual nature that brought him to a sudden halt, but the simple fact that someone other than he was capable of producing that particular effect. It shouldn't have been possible, but there was no mistaking it. Elsewhere in the complex, someone had just opened a window into the beyond. The face of the battle-scarred leader he'd observed in the tram tunnel came instantly to mind, and the Lord of Eden intuitively knew that he was the one. Somehow, he had penetrated the veil, had tunneled through the barriers between worlds, and had peered into the other realm. What the man was looking for, the Lord of Eden did not know, but he instantly recognized that having that particular human at his side would be an advantage in his fight to escape this place. Just like that, his decision was made. He would try to speak to this group of newcomers, try to convince them of the righteousness of his task, and see if they would help him accomplish his aims without resorting to other, more violent measures. And if they chose not to help, he would eliminate them just as he had those who had returned him to the light. He would not be denied. It was as simple as that. Riley gathered the troops and led them through the vault, across the hall beneath the holding cell, and out the other side into a short corridor. This, in turn, ended at another door protected by a card lock. Rather than have Olsen try to jury-rig the lock mechanism, they attempted to use the various pass keys that had been collected from the bodies in the cafeteria and got lucky on the second try. On the other side of the door was a small antechamber. Lockers painted a bright blue lined one wall. Opposite them were a series of stainless steel sinks, four in all. Cotton towels, a light blue in color, were stacked on a shelf nearby. A series of cubbies stood in the center of the room between the lockers and the sinks, and stacked in these were white cotton suits designed to be worn over the clothes. Each suit zipped up the front and included booties to go over the shoes and a shower cap-like hat to cover the head. It was standard cleanroom gear, designed to keep contamination from external sources to a minimum, and the twin set of swinging doors on the far side of the room suggested the presence of a laboratory or assembly room just beyond.
Jen, Duncan, sweep the lockers.
The two men did so, but they came up empty. By the time they'd finished, Kate had made up his mind to continue forward, and Riley took point once more. With the rest of Echo at his back, he eased the doors before him open with one hand. He didn't know what he had expected, but it certainly wasn't this. Emerging from the prep chamber, Riley found himself standing in some sort of containment center. The room had been divided up into what were, in essence, three long corridors. He stood in the central one, his shoulders practically touching the glass walls on either side. Beyond those, against the walls, were a series of what he could only call cells, small glass-fronted enclosures with floors covered in a mat of dirty straw. The walls were concrete, and on the doors were complicated electronic locks holding them shut. There was enough room between the cell doors and the wall of the corridor he stood in to allow room for the handlers to move in and out of the cells, while keeping observers in the center corridor confined away from the action. Even in the dim illumination provided by the emergency lights, Riley could see that the first cells on either side of him were empty. He began edging forward, looking into the cells on either side as he went. In several instances, the doors to the cells were open, but he had no way of reaching them until he had moved half the distance down the hall. There he found a door on either side, leading into the cell access area. A quick discussion led to First Squad taking the corridor on the right, while Riley and the Command Squad would search those on the left. The minute they entered the access corridor, they were smothered with a strange smell that was somehow both inviting and unpleasant at the same time, like the scent of lilacs and jasmine mixed with that of wet fur. It was apparently coming from the cells with the open doors, though neither Riley nor anyone else had any idea what kind of animal would give off a scent like that. Having already determined that the first several cells were empty, he stopped at the next cell, taking a moment to examine the lock on the door. It was of sturdy construction, and he could find no evidence of a short or other mechanical problem. He turned to Cade and indicated the doors with a wave of his hand.
Think they all failed when the power went out?
It's usually the other way around. The power fails and these things lock down tight. Practically impossible to get them open again without restoring the electricity.
Cade glanced up and down the row of cells, and something caught his eye.
That's strange.
Riley turned to follow his gaze. All of the cell doors were unlocked and open, except one, the last. The two men looked at each other, and then wordlessly made their way down the corridor toward it. Much to their surprise, they found the cell occupied. The man looked Indian to Riley, though he supposed he could have been Pakistani, Turkish, or any other Middle Eastern ethnicity. He was short, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5.5 feet, with dark curly hair and an ungroomed beard. He wore a tattered blue jumpsuit with a now-expected Eden patch on his right shoulder. From the accumulated grime on his exposed skin, including his bare feet, it was obvious it had been several days since he'd had the chance to shower. The straw flooring had been pushed into a pile in the corner, and the man was lying either unconscious or asleep on the exposed floor. On the other side of the room were several large jugs of water and a stack of canned goods. Obviously, he'd planned to be in there a while. Riley watched as Cade tried the cell door and discovered it locked. Inside the cell, the man shifted in his sleep, but did not awake.
I want this door open and I don't care how long it takes or what we have to do to open it.
Got it.
First Squad hadn't found anything of note in the opposite cells, so they were called back to join the others. Davis had a fair degree of experience with locking mechanisms, and he was called over to assist Olson as they worked to find a way around the electromagnetic lock that held the door firmly shut. The rest of the men set up a perimeter and prepared to meet any unexpected visitors. Halfway through their efforts, the man inside woke up. He raised himself on one elbow and blinked weary-eyed at them. Riley watched as he first rubbed his eyes, and then, apparently deciding they weren't figments of his imagination, rifled through his pockets until he came up with a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles. He slipped the glasses on.
Hang on! We're gonna get you out!
The Master Sergeant was unprepared for what happened next. The man inside the cell jumped to his feet and rushed the door, the excitement on his face obvious. But the thick glass stole anything the man tried to say to them. As Olson and Davis continued to work, Riley tried to indicate with hand signals that they would have the men free shortly and to just sit back and relax. Unfortunately, that only seemed to get him more worked up.
You think he'll answer our questions?
I don't care whether he wants to or not. He's the first living soul we've seen in this place, and I suspect Cade isn't going to give him a choice.
It took Olson and Davis almost an hour, but they eventually got the door open. The second they had, the prisoner pushed it open and stepped out of the cell.
Oh, thank God. Am I glad to see you? You got him, right? Tell me you got him.
Yeah, we got him. Father Vargas is resting comfortably in a hospital not too far from here. We can take you to see him shortly.
Vargas? You got Vargas?
And like I said, he's all right. As soon as you can tell us what happened here, we'll take you to see him.
I don't give a shit about Vargas! Tell me you killed it! That's all I want to hear! But you blew its divine ass all the way to Kingdom Come, where it belonged!
Look, why don't you tell us your name, and we'll go from there.
The former prisoner stood there, staring. Riley was about to repeat his request when the man flew into action. They had never expected he tried to barrel his way through several well-armed men, and the prisoner was able to get past all three of them, rush up the hall, and reach the door to the central corridor before Riley, close on his heels, brought him down with a picture-perfect tackle.
Get off of me, you stupid son of a bitch! You have no idea what you're doing!
Why don't you explain it to us?
All right, Riley, let him up.
Cade had come down the hall and was now standing in the doorway to the central corridor, his pistol held casually in his hand. Riley had seen him use that weapon without hesitation when he didn't get the answers he wanted, and one glance at the prisoner's face made it clear that he understood the unspoken threat in Kate's stance, too. Riley stood, then reached down, grabbed a hold of the man's bicep, and hauled him, rather reluctantly, to his feet.
Who are you?
The man sullenly stared at the floor and didn't respond.
We can do this the easy way, or... I'm Commander Cade Williams, and you are...
You stupid fool. You have no idea what you are doing here, and if you were smart, you'd get the hell out of here while you still could. This isn't an issue for the army.
With all due respect, I believe I do know what was going on here. But it would certainly be easier if you could fill in a few details. Let's start with your name.
Banji. Dr. Manoj Banji. Chief geneticist.
Well, thank you. That wasn't so hard, now was it?
Oh, look, idiot. I don't give a flying fuck just who you are or how many men you have with you. Unless you've got the entire U.S. Army out there. I was about 100 times better off locked in my little hidey hole back there.
Something in his tone struck a chord with Riley. The man clearly felt he was safer locked up inside his cell, effectively cornered like a rat in the hole, rather than out here with them. It wasn't the glowing endorsement Riley'd expected from someone they'd just extricated from the inside of a glass box. Apparently the comment hit home with Cade, too. As Riley watched, Cade pulled the patch off his eye and turned to look at the glass walls around them.
They're warded. All of the cells are warded.
The prisoner glanced at him, his expression changing from anger to curiosity.
Of course the cells are warded. Do you think we'd have tried to contain them with only bulletproof glass?
Whatever Cade was going to say in response was lost as he whipped his head around to face the entrance they'd passed through more than an hour before. As he turned, Riley could see that his good eye, his left, was still closed, which meant whatever he was seeing was coming to him through the ghost white orb that was all that remained of his right.
Reaper!
The double doors at the end of the hall burst open as the surviving demons from their earlier battles smashed their way through them. The creatures came on without thought to tactics or strategy, and this was just fine with the members of the Echo Team, who wanted nothing more than the chance to avenge Calavecchio's death. As the men from First Squad held off the initial assault, Riley and Cade moved into position behind them. The demons were quite literally cut to pieces by the withering hail of gunfire. By the time Duncan, Olsen, and Davis had moved into position to back them up, the firefight was over. Riley spun around. Down at the other end of the hall, he had the barest glimpse of Dr. Banji being wrapped in inky black wings, and then they were gone. The corridor was empty. With Dr. Banji gone, the chance of learning firsthand just what had happened here disappeared with him, and a sense of gloom settled about the group. That they could have been so careless as to leave him undefended was troubling to say the least. Cade knew it was simply a result of having constantly to be on alert, the pressure slowly chipping away at their awareness and control, but that didn't make things any less disappointing. They continued their search. They moved down the hallway and went through the double doors. What they found there only added to their growing disquiet about the place. The room was clearly a laboratory, and a sophisticated one at that. Olsen wasn't a scientist by any stretch of the imagination, but he considered himself an intelligent man and knew the difference between a microscope and an MRI machine. The equipment in this room, however, defied his understanding. Everywhere he looked, there was some new contraption measuring heaven knows what. But what really caught his eye were the two rows of glass tanks in the center of the room, and he crossed over to them to have a look. They were cylindrical in nature, about 8 feet tall, and filled with a thick liquid that was slightly yellow in color. If anything, they reminded him of giant specimen jars full of formaldehyde. And the comparison was especially apt, for in the last tank on the left, the only one containing anything other than the liquid, there floated the naked body of a young man. Stepping closer, Olsen could see that he just might have to rethink that characterization. The body was clearly humanoid, a torso from which extended two arms and two legs, with a head supported by a neck of the proper proportion. But where there should have been a face, there was only a blank expanse of flesh, like a bare canvas before the painter has arrived. And Olsen couldn't help but stare. No mouth, no nose, no means of air intake. How had it grown to be this big without the ability to breathe? The blankness of the face didn't appear to be the result of an injury, so how had the thing survived for so long? The body was slowly shifting in the fluid in the tank, and Olsen's attention was drawn to its upper left shoulder as it came into view. From its neckline to the middle of its back, the body was covered with a fine, goose-down-like set of feathers. Even stranger, those feathers quickly changed to a set of iridescent scales that were interwoven with each other and covered the entire rest of the thing's left side down to a spot behind the left knee. Just what the hell was this thing? Riley walked up as Olsen stood there staring.
Now that's an ugly son of a gun.
Olsen nodded, not trusting himself to speak. He normally would have been the first to make some lighthearted wisecrack, especially in a tense situation like this. But this thing in front of him was just so inherently wrong that he couldn't find it within himself to do so.
Once, a number of years ago, I had the opportunity to enter a section of the archives I'd never been admitted to before.
Olsen didn't need to ask just which archives he was referring to. For a Templar, there was only one, the archives. A great collection of information and artifacts that the Order had been gathering and cataloging for centuries.
Memory serves, it was just after I transferred into Echo. We were facing a rash of attacks by some unknown cryptid and managed to get some fairly decent casts made from the bite marks on the seventh victim. Kate sent me down to the vaults to see if I could match any of them with the various specimens that had been collected over the years, particularly the ones that had been cataloged at the turn of the century. I'll tell you something. What I saw down in that vault, what we as an order actively collect and store for future studies, made this oddity seem tame in comparison. The world's one strange place, there's no question of that.
As if to punctuate his statement, the thing in the tank suddenly jerked as if awakening abruptly from a long sleep, and its hands slapped palm down against the glass. In the center of each palm was an eye of jet black that stared out at them. After a moment, one of the eyes winked. The shock of realizing that the thing was not only alive but also intelligent washed over Olsen like a bucket of ice water, and he turned away, more profoundly disturbed than at any other time since entering the complex. Whatever it was that they had been doing here, there was no longer any question in his mind that it had been a renegade operation, that the Church would never have condoned it had they known what was happening. From where he stood, Olsen could see eight cubicles against the right-hand wall, the first seven of which contained desktop computers and keyboards, the eighth, a large network printer. And it was for these that he now headed. Riley let him go, more than likely knowing he needed time to think. Olsen stopped at the first workstation and nudged its mouse. The screen powered up as a result, showing the usual Windows login, confirming his unspoken hunch that the PCs had all powered off and then up again when the electricity went out. Now, if he could only get one to work. On a whim, he tried the administrative password and login that every commercially bought PC is shipped with, and was shocked when the machine booted up for him.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Vargas might have brought in some top-of-the-line scientists for whatever they were doing here, but they apparently knew next to nothing about computer security. But it wasn't going to be that easy, and his grin of success soon faded. Sitting down to try and access some of the information on the computer, he discovered the various menu trees and file folders had been individually secured with passwords of their own. He could get into the computer, but not into any of the files that were stored on it. He tried various screen commands and workarounds that he knew, but the computer stubbornly refused to give up its secrets. The desk itself was clear of any paper or notebooks. He moved on to the next PC and booted it up, only to discover the same problem. One by one, he found them all inaccessible. He knew he could eventually break the security system and access the data, but he didn't have the time for such a prolonged process right now. Giving up, he moved to rejoin his companions. As he walked by the final cubicle, the blinking red light on the network printer caught his eye.
Paper jam.
He turned back to the printer and pulled out the paper drawer. It was empty, which meant whatever had been printing might still be in the printer's memory. Olsen began hunting in the drawers around the printer, looking for some paper, and when he found it, quickly refilled the receptacle beneath the printer. He pushed the reset button and waited. 30 seconds later, he pumped his arm in the air in victory as pages of text began to pour out of the device. There were 18 pages in all, each covered with single-space type. Close examination showed them to be selected passages from an individual's personal journal. A glance at the content made it obvious that the journal belonged to one of the scientists, though no names or identifying information was given about either the author or the project in question. The notes themselves chronicled certain events over the course of 6 weeks earlier that summer. Certain sections hinted at the larger picture, but without the complete journal, they were left with more questions than answers. Several of the entries were particularly intriguing, like the one from May 23rd.
The process seems to have taken hold, but only time will tell if it will last. Barajas and Orlander are working on a means of increasing the speed of the development cycle, but they've practically had to start from scratch due to the nature of the specimen, and I, for one, am not confident they can pull it off. We shall see.
Early June held another tantalizing glimpse.
June 14th. Unlike the earlier failures, this time the growth rate seems to be holding steadily at plus 3.68. We've had 4 days without an adjustment, and it looks like it has finally become stable. At this rate, the specimen should be fully grown in just a matter of weeks, rather than the 8 months it had taken with the first attempt. I take back what I said. Orlander is a genius.
Several of the entries were similar. All of them referred to the experiment in evasive terms, as if even the writer was afraid to name just what it was they were doing. Though Olson suspected he might be putting his own subconscious spin on things. Page after page of growth rates and maturation cycles, or starts and stops as the various attempts petered out or took different tracks than had been expected. More than once, the writer cursed their failures. Blame was tossed about with abandon, as if everyone but the writer was responsible for the latest setback or failure, and in the process, Olson learned several of their names. The reconstruction team would at least have a place to start in identifying the dead. The tenor of the journal changed with the last few entries. Apparently, the subject of the experiment was not cooperating in the way they'd expected.
July 6th. Questions are now going unanswered. Subject B exhibiting the petulance of a teenager, refusing to do the simple tasks or carry out the smallest requests. His demands continue, and this has some of us worried. Vargas intends to continue with the stated protocol. July 9th. Violence for the first time today. Jackson's arm was broken when the evening meal was being delivered. Vargas has ordered Subject B to be isolated for a period of 48 hours. I'm certain it's a mistake.
And then, nothing more. The ambiguousness of the notes was further proof that they had lost a valuable resource when Dr. Banji had disappeared. He could have cleared up any number of their questions. Olson was sure of it. He brought the notes over to Cade and let him know how he'd come to possess them.
Strip the hard drives out of a few of the PCs. We'll take them back with us and see what we can uncover with the right time and the proper tools.
When Olson was finished, they left the crèche room behind, this time with Riley on point. For the next 20 minutes, they passed through several corridors filled with a series of additional labs, but nothing of interest was uncovered in any of them, and Riley began to feel like they were simply spinning their wheels on this level, as room after room passed by without further clues. Hearing the sound, Riley gave the signal and stopped. Behind him, the others did the same. Cade came up the line and settled against the wall next to Riley.
What do we got?
Listen.
Any ideas?
Not a one.
Then that doesn't leave us much choice now, does it?
Cade turned and signaled to the others that they were to stay in place while he and Riley checked things out. They advanced carefully toward the bend in the corridor ahead of them. When they reached it, Riley removed a small mirror from a pocket of his fatigues and held it out at an angle before him so he could see around the corner without exposing himself. He took a long look and then pulled his hand back.
You better take a look. It's Banji.
They switched positions, Cade extending the mirror around the corner just as Riley had. With it, he could see that the hallway continued for another 20 feet before ending at a reinforced pressure door. Attached to that door was the stripped body of a man. Bruises covered him from head to toe, and there was more than a handful of open bleeding wounds across his flesh, as if he'd been cut by a knife. He was arrayed against the door in a classic crucifixion pose, with his arms stretched out on both sides and his feet placed atop one another. Even from this distance, Cade could see the large spikes that had been driven through his limbs to hold him in place, one in each arm just above the elbow, and another through his feet. The odd sounds were a result of his hands flapping like trapped birds against the door as he twitched in pain. His head hung downward, giving Cade only a partial glimpse of his face. But even in the small surface of the mirror, Cade could see that it was indeed the missing Dr. Banji. Taking his attention away from the wounded scientist, Cade angled the mirror first in one direction and then the other. By doing so, he could see that there were no other entrances into the corridor, so they couldn't be flanked if they moved forward. An attack through the ceiling seemed unlikely, as did one coming up through the floor, which meant that there were only two directions that they had to worry about. Back down the hallway behind them, or through the door to which Dr. Banji was nailed.
Feels more like a warning than a trap.
Agreed.
All right, let's see if we can get the poor bastard down.
Riley listened in as Kate called Olson over the tactical net and gave orders for the rest of the team to move up to their present position. In a low voice, he explained that First Squad would be in charge of keeping them safe, while the members of the command unit would see what they could do about getting Dr. Banji free.
Chen, you guard the approach down the corridor, in case something tries to come from behind us.
Once everyone understood their respective roles, the team moved into action like the well-oiled mechanism that they were. Those assigned to provide cover swiftly took their positions, while Riley, Olson, Kate, and Duncan moved in on the good doctor. Riley cringed at the sound. No human being should ever be reduced to such fear and pain.
It's Commander Williams, Dr. Banji. You take it easy. We're here to help you. We're gonna try and get you down.
The doctor visibly relaxed when he understood it was not his captor coming back to torture him further, his hands stopping their panicked fluttering, and his head slumped forward on his chest in exhaustion. Cade reached out, and Riley watched as he gently lifted the man's head. What had been done to him was hideous. Dr. Banji's eyes had been torn out, the sockets now raw bloody wounds in the canvas of the man's face. His lips had been stitched together with what looked like electrical wire, and a word had been scrawled across his forehead in blood. Riley might not read Hebrew, but he knew his biblical Greek well enough. Paradidami, betrayer. Someone was very unhappy with this man. His teammates stepped up and grasped the doctor's arms and body, supporting him under the armpits, doing what they could to take the pressure off his lungs and give him a chance to breathe a bit easier. Cade looked over at Riley, silently asking if he was ready for what was to come. Riley nodded. They had no choice. It had to be done. Riley moved forward and grasped Dr. Banji's right forearm, locking it firmly in place against the door, preventing it from moving. He nodded again to Cade, but he was ready. Using a set of pliers from Olsen's tech kit, Cade placed one foot against the door beneath the doctor's arm, grabbed the protruding end of the spike with the teeth of the pliers, and hauled backward with all his might. Banji tore his sewn lips apart. Riley was not surprised to see a tear on Duncan's face before he turned away. He felt like crying himself. The spike had barely moved. The pain had to be excruciating, and at this rate it was going to take a while before the spike came free. Never mind the other two that would have to follow the first. Cade went back to work. It took them more than 20 minutes just to work the first spike free. Dr. Banji lapsed into unconsciousness after a few minutes, unable to bear the horrible agony. And Riley found himself offering a silent prayer of thanks that he did not have to listen to the man's agony any longer. The second and third spikes took even longer. By the time they were able to gently lower the doctor to the floor, Riley's sympathy had turned to raging anger. Whoever had done this would pay, he vowed, no matter how long it took. He hadn't liked the man, had despised him a bit even, but no one should have to undergo such pain and suffering at the hands of another. As they got up to give him some room, Banji stopped breathing.
Damn it!
Riley knelt beside him, yanked Dr. Banji's shirt open, and began giving him CPR, cursing their luck all the while. After 20 minutes, he gave up, unable to get Dr. Banji's heart restarted. Rocking back on his heels, he did what he could to catch his own breath. Cade wasn't about to give up that easily, however. He suspected Dr. Banji had known far more than he'd let on, and he wasn't about to let him take that information with him to the grave if he could help it. It was time for the gloves to come off, literally. He let the others know what he intended.
You sure about this? This isn't the most secure location, you know.
I'll be quick. I don't want to be lost in his memories for long. His last few moments weren't all that pleasant, and I don't want to relive them unless absolutely necessary.
Cade knew he was going to get some of it no matter what he did, but he hoped that the man's close proximity to death would have had him mentally focused on more important matters there at the end. Reluctantly, his exec nodded his agreement, and then set about doing what he could to provide Cade as much security as possible. Cade knelt on the floor and stripped off his gloves, just as he had back in the walk-in freezer. He remembered his failure there, but quickly dismissed it as irrelevant. Lingering psychic impressions often dissipated within 48 hours, and they'd had no idea how long that man had been dead when he tried to read him. But they just watched Banji die. His final thoughts and feelings were still locked up in the shell of his body, and Cade was confident he could tease them free. Kate reached out and put his bare palms on either side of Dr. Banji's face. As soon as he did, a kaleidoscope of images surged past, as if Banji had indeed seen his life flash before him there at the end. Cade struggled to narrow his focus, to separate the wheat from the chaff and get something meaningful from the montage that played on, despite Banji's passing. Heat, sand and rock, the quiet hiss of the wind as it skittered across the ground and echoed softly in the trenches they dug that morning.
Who else knows?
No one.
I've been working this end of the trench all day by myself. You're the first to see it other than me.
A flash of darkness. And then he stood in a conference room, confronting a gray-haired man in a white lab coat. Underneath it, Kate could see that the man wore a blue jumpsuit. They were having a heated argument, and Kate could feel his disdain and contempt for the man in front of him, but he couldn't make out the words or understand just what the fight was about. The other man finally threw down his pen in disgust and left the room, leaving Banji to stare smugly at the closing door.
Now the real work can begin.
His pulse surged. Another scene swam into view, and this time Kate found himself gazing down at a deformed mass of flesh that vaguely resembled a human being lying stretched out on a steel table in a lab somewhere. Various parts of it were recognizable for what they should have been. Those short, twisted appendages had tried to be arms. That long, thick trunk might have later developed into legs. And in the center of that bulging mass that served as its head, clear as day, was a human eye. As he watched, the eye turned and looked at him. He felt the tears running down his cheeks now and held his breath as the thing opened up a gaping maw in the center of its chest that might eventually have served as a mouth. The scene changed a fourth and final time, the transition so sudden and so jarring that Kate was almost swept away in its unstoppable tide. Agony, sheer, unrelenting agony as the spike pierced his feet and sank deeply into the metal of the door behind. Through the pain, the questions had never stopped. Questions to which he had no answer.
What is your purpose? Who are your allies? Where are the Watchers and what happened to the throne?
Question after question, none of which made any sense. Through it all, there was the face. And with that face, a command to commit it to memory, a command felt down in the very center of his bones, as if placed there at the long-forgotten time of his creation, and only activated now when it was urgently needed, in order to be certain that every single detail, every nuance and expression, every blemish and wrinkle be saved for what was to come thereafter. With the aid of his gift, Cade saw the face that Dr. Banji had committed to memory. The face of the individual that had tortured him for what seemed like hours. A face of smooth planes and unblemished skin. A face with a mouth that seemed forever locked in a perpetual sneer. A face with coal black eyes that bored into his own, searching, prying, hunting for the answers it so desperately needed. And with that face, a name.
Barakel.
It was the clue Kate had been looking for. Kate broke contact and collapsed to the floor beside the professor's body. They had a name now. And in the circles that Kate traveled in, names meant power. For the first time since entering the facility known as Eden, Knight Commander Cade Williams displayed a wolfish smile of his own. Cade needed some time to rest and regain his strength after his viewing, so Echo took a short break. As they did, Riley and Olsen went to work on the door that Dr. Banji had been crucified against, eventually prying it open to find a single set of stairs just beyond. The steps led upward another entire level. At the top, they found a door secured by another key code device, the third they'd seen since entering the complex the day before. This time, however, the pass keys they'd acquired in the cafeteria did no good. Olsen pulled out his tools and started in on the door while the others took five. The events of the last half hour must have hit him harder than he thought. He noticed his hands were shaking as he attached the various leads and set his handheld to trying to find the right combination to open the door.
You all right?
Olsen jumped and nearly yelled aloud. He hadn't realized that Cade had climbed the last few steps to stand next to him.
I'm good, boss.
Cade eyed him for a minute, nodded, and then turned away without saying anything further. Olsen knew he hadn't fooled him, but also knew that Cade was confident that Olsen could handle whatever was thrown their way, and Cade's lack of further questioning was proof once more that he trusted him. It was exactly what Olsen needed to cast off the willies he'd been experiencing and get back to work with renewed vigor.
And I'll bet he knew it, too.
At that moment, the handheld beeped, indicating that it had found the proper sequence.
I got it.
Riley and Cade set up beside him in the narrow landing. He input the correct combination, glanced at them to be certain they were ready, and then hauled open the door. They swept past him quickly, ready for whatever might be waiting for them. Which turned out to be nothing. At least, nothing life-threatening. The door opened onto a set of personal quarters, but these were far more lushly appointed than any they had discovered previously. Where the others were simple dormitory-style setups with communal bathrooms and no dining facilities, this space was actually divided into four separate rooms, with its own bathroom and even a mini kitchen with a small dinette set and a stovetop. The furniture here was of much nicer caliber as well. The couch in the living room was genuine leather, and the desk in the study was clearly polished oak. Even more surprising, the far wall of the study was made up of a huge window that looked out upon the mountainside and the base below. Outside, Olsen could see that the funnel cloud they'd tangled with the day before was still there, churning up the ground and casting a dark cloud of dust and grit over the entire facility. For the first time since entering the complex, Olsen found himself glad he was inside here instead of out there amidst the storm. The desk held a computer, the first he'd seen outside of the labs, and he suspected that they'd finally found the base commander's personal quarters. The stack of handwritten journals they found in the desk drawers confirmed that fact. Inside the cover of each, written in spidery yet meticulous handwriting, it read,
Dr. Juan Vargas, Notes and Observations, The Eden Project.
It was the goldmine of information they had been looking for. The only problem was that the rest of the pages were written in a strange, indecipherable language that wasn't familiar to any of them. While the others were flipping through the pages of the journals, trying to make heads or tails of the odd script, Olsen found himself wandering around the perimeter of the room, poking at this and that, his thoughts wandering. One wall held a large tapestry, and he idly pushed one edge to the side. To his surprise, he found another doorway concealed behind it. Brushing the tapestry aside, he stepped through the entryway, only to be brought up short by what he saw just beyond.
Hey, boss, you better get in here!
Responding to the urgency in his voice, both Williams and Riley rushed into the room, weapons ready, only to stop short themselves when they saw what he was looking at.
Mary and Joseph.
Kind of catches your attention now, doesn't it?
It was astounding. Olsen had seen some amazing things since joining the Order, but this one had to take the prize. The stone itself was huge. It covered nearly the entire wall, a length of more than 20 feet and a good 10 or so in height, near as he could estimate. It looked to be a good foot thick, too. It appeared to him to be some kind of shale or slate, though he'd be the first to admit his knowledge of geology was limited. Still, he'd seen his share of fossils embedded in similar rocks, and he didn't think he was too far off the mark. The stone was resting on what could only be specially designed supports, for the weight alone would cause the average wall to collapse as if it were made of toothpicks. Small spotlights had been arranged along the ceiling and floor to artistically showcase the display. Yet it wasn't the stone that had captured his amazement, or the way it had been so carefully hung, but what was embedded within it. The skeleton had to be at least several thousand years old, and he would have bet good money that it was even older than that. It looked ancient. It stood almost as tall as the stone itself, and was nearly perfectly preserved. The skull had a strong brow and a large cranium, indicative that it had probably been highly intelligent. Based on the thickness of the bones in the arms and legs, Olsen could only imagine the strength the creature must have possessed. But it was the wings that truly captured his attention. They stretched out all the way to the edge of the stone on either side of the skeleton, a wingspan of nearly 20 feet. The feathers themselves had been preserved in the fossilization process, and in many cases the individual shafts and veins were clearly visible, etched into the stone. When the creature had been alive, it must have been an awesome sight.
The creature?
It wasn't a creature, except in the sense that it had been created.
Stop being such a wimp and admit the obvious.
It was much more than a creature. It could only be one of the B'nai Elohim, the sons of God.
An angel.
The idea that he was standing in front of the skeletal remains of one of the holiest creations ever devised by the Lord was amazing, beyond amazing. While it was nothing more than a skeleton now, he could imagine that this being had once stood in the very presence of God. It had probably fought on the side of righteousness and stood as a soldier in the Lord's army. One of its brethren had swept through the city of Pharaoh and had slaughtered all of the firstborn. Another had freed Peter from his chains and helped him escape from imprisonment in Rome. Four such beings now stood at the corners of the earth, holding back the winds of heaven. They were the messengers and the arm of justice of God himself. But as Olsen gaped in wonder, another, more ominous thought suddenly occurred to him. He was making assumptions, and unfounded ones at that. Not all of the angels had been on the side of righteousness. Not all of them had fought on the side of heaven. There were also the Nephilim, the fallen ones, those who had been cast out, those who had sided with Lucifer and had been thrown from the mount of heaven for their sin of pride. B'nai Elohim or Ephilim? The odds were 50-50.
Looks like they removed a piece.
Riley pointed to a spot on the left foot where it was obvious one of the metatarsals had been carefully removed from the stone. Olsen bent over to give it a closer look, and that's when it hit him. The quote carved over the front entrance to the secret complex, the Kreis chamber and its accompanying tanks, the notes from the journal discussing the rapid growth techniques employed to bring the subject to adulthood. They all added up to one inescapable conclusion, and it came clear to him with the force of a runaway locomotive. Olsen looked up from the stone to find Cade staring at him with an expression of awestruck horror. The same expression Olsen knew was plastered across his own face.
Oh, good Lord. Tell me he didn't.
Olsen was unable to respond, for he was quite certain that Vargas had indeed done the unthinkable. The stupid fool had tried to clone an angel from the fossilized remains hanging on the wall before them. Even worse, he'd apparently succeeded. Shocked at the audacity and pride inherent in Vargas's experiment, Cade stepped out of the fossil room, his thoughts whirling, and the rest of Echo followed at his heels. The moment they emerged from the back room, a blazing light filled the space around them. When the light faded, Echo was no longer alone.
Do not be afraid!
The angel's very presence was a burden to bear in and of itself, pressing against them with a physical weight all its own. And Duncan finally understood why the first words spoken by an angel whenever it appeared to mortals in the Bible were always the same. He was afraid, and he knew that nothing the creature before them said was going to change that. The only one of the Echo members who didn't seem particularly cowed was Cade. He stood in front of the newcomer, his back straight and his head held high, waiting.
I am the messenger of the Lord, and I bring good news.
The angel Barakel spread his arms the way one would welcome a close friend or family member, and smiled at them.
You welcome us? Is that what you've been doing?
Surely you expected a test of your abilities when you entered this place. I've simply supplied a reasonable challenge to determine your worthiness, to see if you were the man I have been waiting for.
Duncan couldn't hold his tongue any longer. This thing had slaughtered an entire base full of scientists, had defiled the dead, had sent hellspawn demons to attack them, and had killed their friend. He would listen to no more.
We will have nothing to do with an abomination!
Silence!
Duncan was unable to move anything but his eyes. Barako waved his other hand, and the rest of Echo was seized in his power as well. Everyone but Cade, who still stood in the vanguard of the unit, casually facing down Hell's own representative. Cade did what he could to maintain his outward facade, but inside he trembled with the display of power he had just seen. He had to learn what this creature wanted, had to buy some time for them to figure out just how to gain the upper hand. Showing fear would get him slaughtered like a sheep in a pen, and he knew his men wouldn't last 10 seconds after that. For now, he would play along.
A test. Okay, I can see that. And your presence here means we passed.
Barakel waved his hand disdainfully at the men of Echo, arrayed in a semicircle behind Cade.
You passed. They did not. I should slay them out of hand.
Wait. You tested me to see if I was worthy? Worthy of what?
Now that's the question, isn't it? Turn around and look.
Knowing the angel was likely to strike him down where he stood if he refused, Cade did so, turning his back on his foe, an action that went against every bit of combat training he'd ever received. He could feel the hairs on the back of his neck rise up in protest, but what choice did he have? Through the panoramic window that Vargas had installed in his office, Cade could see the visible portion of the base at the foot of the mountain below, and beyond that, the desert stretched out like a vast carpet. Barakel's breath washed over the back of his neck, and Cade's skin crawled at the thought that something so dangerous could have gotten so close without a sound. That sickly, sweet smell of lilacs and wet fur suddenly filled the air around him, and Cade finally realized just what it was that Vargas had been keeping locked up in the cells two floors below. The angel's arm extended over Cade's shoulder, and with a wave of his hand, the desert was transformed into a vibrant city of soaring towers, all polished steel and shining glass.
Look! Look at that! It could all be yours!
How? What do I have to do to get it?
I need a human regent to enforce my decrees. One I can trust. A man of power and determination. One that can be counted on to do the right thing, no matter how difficult it may appear.
And it would be all mine?
Yes. You will be the master of every inch, every gleaming spire.
Riley stood to Cade's left, still struggling against whatever power the angel had used to hold him frozen in place. Cade caught his gaze with his own and flashed the hand signal for be ready. Riley blinked twice to show he understood. Cade reached up and yanked the patch off his face, activating his sight as he did so. A shimmering braid of phantasmic energy extended from the angel to each of his teammates, and it was this energy that was holding them in place, immobile. If he could break that connection. Cade turned to look at Barakel, still using his sight, and had to force himself not to recoil at what he saw. Gone was the human countenance, the smile and the false glory. In its place was a hulking brute of a creature, with tattered black wings and sores oozing over its exposed skin, sores that leaked an inky black ichor down across its gray flesh. Strangely, there was no aura around the creature, no evidence of the divine spark that Cade had encountered in every living thing that he had viewed through his sight. Either the creature before him had been created without a soul, or something had stolen it somewhere along the way. Cade's MP5 hung by its strap from his right shoulder, and he casually let his right hand slide around its grip, his fingers slipping through the trigger guard, as he turned his body slightly in that direction to hide his actions from view. Barakel spun around suddenly, his eyes narrowing as he sensed Cade's use of his sight.
What are you doing?
Cade glanced down at the ground and turned off his sight, taking a calculated gamble that the angel wouldn't destroy him on the spot. And then Cade looked back up with what he hoped was an appropriately fawning expression on his face.
What do I have to do to gain such riches?
Barakel smiled, and Cade nearly grinned himself as he realized the hook had been properly baited.
I know you are different from your less gifted companions, that you have minor powers of your own. I will teach you how to use them, how to make them grow in power and intensity. In return, you will remove the ward surrounding this place, so I will not have to waste my time with such trivial things. After that, you will secure us a new location from which we plan our conquest. Are you ready to seize your destiny?
Oh yeah.
Barakel reacted to the assault, swinging his wings around in front of him as a shield. But the attack had accomplished what it had been meant to. That braid of twisting and churning energy that had wrapped each of the men of Echo Team into immobility slipped away into oblivion the minute Barakel's attention went elsewhere. Thanks to Cade's prior warning, Riley was ready when he felt the pressure constricting him fall away. Without hesitation, he vaulted forward into a roll, twisting around as he did, so that when he came back up on his feet, he was closer to Cade and facing in the same direction. As Cade's magazine ran dry, Riley raised his shotgun.
Go ahead and shoot! Your puny weapons cannot hurt me!
Raising his arm, Barakel sent a shaft of blue witchfire leaping across the room. It struck Cade full on. Cade slipped to the floor, unconscious. Guns were not the only weapons Echo carried, however. Even as Barakel was turning to target another member of the team, Davis rose up from behind the desk where he'd hidden until now and stabbed the angel through the back with a blessed sword every Templar knight carried into battle. A ribbon of blue energy shot back down the blade of the sword. Riley watched it rise up on flapping wings. In that second, he knew he'd never forget the look of utter hatred on the creature's face as it stared into his eyes. And then it brought its hands together in a thunderclap that sent a tidal wave of energy pouring forth across the room. Duncan slowly came back to consciousness. Raising a hand to his face, he wiped off the sheen of moisture that had accumulated there and opened his eyes. The ceiling above him swam slowly into view, but what he saw there was not what he expected. Suddenly concerned, he sat up and looked around. The room they were in was roughly the same as it had been before the fight. Riley and Olsen lay where they had fallen, near the large window that looked out over the base proper. Ortega was to Duncan's left, and like him, was just struggling to sit up. To Duncan's right, Chen was already awake and tending to a wounded Davis, who looked like he had a broken arm. The angel was nowhere to be seen. No more or less than he'd expected, given the confrontation they had just gone through. The disconcerting issue was the fact that everything around him seemed to have been leached of color, like a tablecloth left too long in the sun. Everything, including his teammates, was some subtle shade of gray. Gray floor, gray ceiling, gray flesh, gray, gray, gray. If Duncan had not encountered the phenomenon before, he might have thought he'd suffered some kind of injury to his eyes. But he knew all too well what the change meant. With rising horror, he realized that they were no longer in the real world, but had somehow slipped through the barrier and into the beyond.
Cade?
Where was Cade? Another glance around showed that the situation was even worse than he had feared. The one man who could take them out of here was nowhere in sight. Cade was missing. Getting to his feet, Duncan moved over to where Riley and Olsen lay and did what he could to rouse them. They came to slowly, groggily, and it was several minutes before they were coherent enough to understand their predicament. By then, Chen had managed to get Davis's arm into a makeshift sling, and the two had wandered over to join them.
What the hell's happened to my eyes?
Duncan did what he could to reassure them all that their vision was just fine. It was their current location that they had to worry about. His revelation was by no means something they were happy to hear. Nor was the news that Cade was missing.
That bastard son of the devil must have him.
Duncan was afraid that Chen might just be right. But Riley wasn't willing to accept that without a thorough search of the room around them, and so they set out to do just that. Much to everyone's surprise, especially Duncan's, they found Cade in the alcove behind the tapestry, lying at the foot of the wall where the stone containing Barakel's skeleton had hung in the real world. Here, the stone was simply bare rock. How he got there was anyone's guess. The Knight Commander was unconscious, with a raw, bloody wound on the left side of his head. Riley and Olsen picked him up and carried him back out into the main room, where Chen could properly dress and bandage the wound. Cade remained unconscious throughout, and nothing they did would revive him.
Now what?
As Echo's executive officer, Riley took command in Cade's absence, or in this case, incapacitation.
We get the heck out of this place. There's no way we can take on something like that without reinforcement. We'll come back with the right firepower and blast that thing back to hell where it belongs.
He hefted Cade in his arms, uncomfortably aware that this whole mess had started with him holding his friend in the exact same manner, and ordered them back to the tram tunnel several floors below. But things weren't that easy in the beyond. The landscape there was constantly shifting, like a funhouse mirror gone berserk, hauntingly familiar, yet intimately strange. Where they expected to find corridors, they found rooms, where they remembered a door that was only a stretch of blank wall. Everything was the same, yet different. And in the beyond, the Eden facility showed its true nature. It was rotten at the core, like a fruit left too long in the sun, and the walls of the tunnels around them displayed this fact. Patches of luminescent fungus grew in more than one place, often hanging down and obscuring the path forward until the lead knight cleared them away with several sharp hacks of a sword. Pools of dank water were puddled here and there, and more than once they came upon broken sections of pipe sticking out through the walls and pouring filth down into their path. 3 hours after they had started, Duncan had to admit to himself that they were hopelessly lost. Nor had they once seen a single rift that might carry them back into the real world. Several times, reality shifted around them. For just a split second, they found themselves back in the real world, with the dim emergency lighting overhead and the flat institutional 1960s corridors beneath their feet. But this never lasted long enough for them to do anything with it. It was during their second rest break when Cade had the first of his seizures. Olsen and Riley leapt to his assistance, holding Cade's arms and legs while Duncan slid his pack beneath Cade's head to keep him from smashing his skull against the stone floor. The seizure went on for 5 long minutes, and when it was over, Cade lay still in their arms, breathing slowly but steadily. Chen gave him a quick examination and then sat back on his heels, frowning.
What?
I've done all I can for the wound on the outside. It's the inside that I'm worried about. That kind of seizure is usually caused by internal injuries. That is not good. Not good at all.
So what's the bottom line?
We need to get him to a hospital. And we need to do it so quickly. The sooner the better.
Riley simply nodded his understanding. There wasn't much more to say. He was doing all he could to find a way out of this place. He wanted to go home as much as everyone else did. He called Duncan over and grilled him again for what he knew about the Beyond. But the other man had only been there once, and had little to add to the meager information Olsen and Riley had provided. After a few minutes of rest, they set out again. But this time, in the back of Riley's mind, a clock had begun ticking. Echo spent the next several hours trooping through corridor after corridor, searching fruitlessly for a way out. Several times they came upon half-congested staircases, but after clambering over the debris and descending to another level, all they found was more of the same. The team was exhausted, especially with the added burden of having to carry Cade everywhere they went, and at last Riley called a halt. They would get some food and some rest, try again with a fresh outlook in the morning. Sometime later, Duncan was relieved of guard duty by Chen. Too awake to sleep, his thoughts churning at high speed, the newest member of Echo Team went looking for its executive officer. He found him a short distance down the hall, sitting watch beside Cade's wounded form.
Hey, you got a minute?
It's on your mind.
The younger man sat down, glancing once at Cade as he did so, but then turning away, uncomfortable that he couldn't bring himself to reveal his abilities to the rest of the group and heal their commander.
If it gets worse, I'll see what I can do. There's time left still. We'll get out of here before I need to do anything drastic.
Duncan turned his attention back to what he'd come here to say.
I've been doing some thinking, trying to figure out just what is going on, why things keep shifting the way they do. And I keep coming back to Vargas's arrogant belief that he could pull off a stunt like this without there being any major repercussions.
I'm listening.
Well, we know that angels are multiplanar beings, right? I mean, they exist in both a physical and spiritual realm at the same time, just as we do.
Riley nodded, waiting to see where the younger man was going.
And we know that once the physical body dies, the spirit continues, and that death is not the end, but the beginning of a new kind of existence.
We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed. In a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will all be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. 1 Corinthians 15:51.
Right. Clothe the mortal with immortality. Death transforms us into something more.
I'm certainly not going to argue with the Apostle Paul, but what does that have to do with our situation? Are you intending to become immortal anytime soon?
Not me, the angel, Barakel. We know that it died once. That fossilized skeleton hanging on the wall back there is proof of that. And it's reasonable to assume that when it died, its spiritual nature was separated from its physical one. Its body died, but its soul, if that's what you want to call it, continued on in the spiritual realm.
Okay, so what?
So what if by bringing its body back, Vargas and his men have upset the balance between the physical and the spiritual realms? What if the angel's spiritual form is trying to reunite with its physical one?
What difference would that make?
The angel is no longer a creature created and formed by God, but one given life by human hands, and that means it's missing that essential spark of divinity that identifies it as one of God's own.
So?
So, think about this for a minute. It knows it's been diminished, that it is less than it was before. It knows that it is separated from an essential part of its very nature, and that the missing piece, that divine soul, if you will, is still out there somewhere. It obviously has power, great power even, but it is still less than it was before, and it knows it. It knows it. Now, what would you do in that situation? You'd do everything you could to make yourself whole again, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I guess I would.
So it's reasonable to assume that the angel is trying to do the same thing, isn't it?
And by doing so, it is somehow causing these disruptions around us?
Yeah, I think so.
But how?
How on earth should I know? I don't think the mechanics of it are all that important, though. I mean, it's the end result that we need to be concerned with.
Because every time it tries to bring its soul back across into this side of reality, it's weakening the veil that much more, allowing the beyond to leak into our world.
And right now, the hole isn't all that big. But as more time passes, it will get bigger, and eventually it will be too big to contain. When that happens, the veil will fall. The beyond will merge with reality as we know it.
And that would be very, very bad.
Later that night, Olsen jerked awake as he felt Cade moving beside him in the semi-darkness. A quick flash of his light told him all he needed to know. The Night Commander was in the throes of another seizure, the worst one yet. His head jerked from side to side, setting his wound to bleeding again.
Riley!
Olsen did what he could to hold Cade steady as the tremors ran their course. It seemed like forever, but in truth it was only a matter of moments before he felt another presence, and a second pair of hands joined his own.
Damn! It's getting worse, isn't it?
Yeah, they're coming faster now. This is the third one in the last 2 hours.
We've got to get out of here and get him to a doctor.
Yeah, sure. Let me just whistle up a transdimensional taxi cab and we'll scoot right over to the nearest ER.
Beneath their hands, Cade shuddered and then went still. Olsen's breath caught in his throat, his fear making his heart pound like a drum, and he snatched his light off the floor, not caring anymore about giving their position away to whatever might be waiting out there in the dark. He flipped the switch and shone the light on Cade's face, holding it steady. The seizure had stopped. Their friend was breathing slowly, but normally.
Oh, thank God.
The crisis now passed. Olsen and Riley slumped against the wall on either side of Cade and tried to get their hearts back under control. The sense that time was running out was obvious to them both. They had to do something and do it soon if they wanted to keep Cade alive long enough to get the medical attention he needed.
How long you think we got?
I don't know. Heaven only knows how bad that head wound is on the inside, and those seizures can't be helping the matter any. If their frequency keeps increasing, I'd say we've got several hours, half a day at most. Then again, I'm not a doctor. He could have 10 minutes for all I know.
Then it's time to try something new.
They'd been so involved in helping Cade that they hadn't seen nor heard Duncan approach.
I'm open to suggestions.
The newest member of the Echo team knelt on the ground at Cade's feet. He opened his mouth to speak, but closed it again before saying anything. To Olsen, it was clear he was struggling with something, but they simply didn't have the time to be gentle or diplomatic about it.
Just say it, for heaven's sake.
Remember the helicopter? That night at the Necromancer stronghold.
How could he forget? They'd tracked the Necromancer and his infamous Council of Nine to their stronghold in the Louisiana swamps, had assaulted the place in an all-out attack to regain the Spear of Longinus that the group had stolen from the Order. Duncan had been with him in the helicopter hovering over the estate when the Necromancer had called a demon down out of the clouds. The beast had made short work of their vehicle, and the pilot barely had time to warn them before they'd plummeted from the sky and smashed straight through the roof of the decaying mansion below them.
What about it?
You almost died that night.
Yeah, so?
Olsen unconsciously rubbed his chest. He'd later learned that he'd been impaled on a 2-foot piece of steel, and it had only been Duncan's swift medical attention that had saved his life.
When I got to you, you were all but dead. That pipe was sticking right out of your chest. There was blood everywhere. I didn't have any choice. I had to do it.
What did you do, Duncan?
The younger man looked over at his teammate, as if seeing him for the first time. Duncan lifted his hands and held them up before him.
I healed him.
The other two men stared in stunned silence.
You did what?
Just what I said. I healed him. I knew he had only moments left to live. There was blood everywhere, and that pipe had gone right through his lung. If he didn't bleed to death, he was going to drown in his own blood. I had to do something.
Duncan glanced back and forth between them, and it seemed to Olson that he was searching for something. Absolution, maybe? Duncan focused on Olson again.
When I pulled that pipe out of your chest, the blood started pumping like a fountain, and I didn't even think. I just put my hands over your wound, prayed that God would be with me and healed you. It's what I do.
Olson could only continue to stare. It was a fantastic story, but something inside told him it was all completely true. Duncan had healed him. He had no doubt about it. But what did that mean?
You said it's what you do. You mean you've done this before?
Ever since I was a child. They'd come from miles. The sick and the injured to see Pastor Duncan and his miracle boy.
Olson could hear that there was more to the story than that, but now was not the time. He steered the conversation back to the present.
Can you heal Kate?
I think so. Yes, at least I can give it a try.
I don't know, man. What if something goes wrong? What if he causes more harm than good?
Look around you, Matt. Does it look like we're going anywhere anytime soon? If he can heal Cade, then maybe Cade can take us back across the veil, get us back to our version of reality. That's our only chance. It's Cade's only chance. Look at him, for God's sake. He's not going to last another 2 hours at this rate.
Riley couldn't argue with that. Without another word, he nodded his agreement.
What do you need us to do?
Nothing, I guess. At least I don't think there's anything you can do. It's up to God, really. I'm just the conduit.
Riley moved out of the way, allowing Duncan to get close to Cade. As they watched, their teammate crossed himself, bowed his head in prayer, and then placed his hands on the bandages covering Cade's head wound. For several long moments, nothing happened. Duncan just sat there with his head bowed and his hands on Cade, a look of intense concentration on his face. Olson felt his impatience growing thin and was about to say something when Duncan sat back and yanked his hands away from Cade.
Fuck! What is it? What's wrong?
There's something wrong in Cade's head.
You mean with the wound?
No, I mean with his head, inside his head. There's something in there that shouldn't be there.
Can you get rid of it?
That's just it. I don't think I should. I've seen enough to know that Cade's encounter with the adversary left him with a few unusual traits. Like that thing he does with his hands, or the way he crossed into the beyond. I mean, he couldn't do that stuff before, right?
Not that I know of.
Okay. So that means that whatever else the adversary did to him, it also somehow gave him those new abilities.
So?
So we need those abilities to get out of here. I don't have any control over what I heal. I mean, it's not selective or anything. What if I heal Cade and end up healing whatever it is the adversary did to him? What do we do then?
The three men stared at each other, confounded by the choice before them. If they did nothing, Cade would probably die. If they healed him, they might save his life, but might also maroon them all in the beyond forever. It wasn't the best hand they could have drawn.
Wait a minute. You healed him before without changing anything, right?
Wait, what? What are you talking about?
Back in the hospital, before we jetted off on this insane assignment, Cade was so weak he could barely lift a hand, never mind walk. We left you alone in his hospital room just before our meeting with the Preceptor. 20 minutes later, the Night Commander walks into the briefing like nothing happened. There was no way he could have done that on his own. You healed him, right?
No, I didn't heal him. I simply said a few prayers and left.
But if you didn't heal him, who did?
We've got company!